Today's podcast is loaded with stuff. The Kyrie news, what does it really mean? Also, receipts and living rent-free. Chris Finch, head coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves, and life advice. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. I want to start today's podcast before we get to all the other stuff that we have for you, talking about Kyrie Irving. All right, let's get the news part out of the way. Earlier this week, Shams Charania of The Athletic said that there's an impasse between Kyrie and the Nets on his new on a new contract for him, and that if it doesn't quite work out, the Lakers, the Clippers, and the Knicks are all super interested. So I want to examine a bunch of these different things. Here's the important stuff. There's a $36.9 million player option that Kyrie has to make a decision on by June 29th. Pretty simple. If Kyrie picks it up, he's under contract for at least one more year, and the Nets and him can work out another deal. But it also makes him a lot easier to trade as opposed to a sign and trade that has complications for these other teams. The Nets, as ridiculous as it sounds, because if you just ask me straight up, do you want to be in the Kyrie Irving business? In a vacuum, it's a no for me every single time. And I think it should be a no for almost all of these teams. But for the Nets, as we've been over this before, it's like my Celtics buddies were like, well, cool, that means if we don't sign Gordon Hayward, we can just use the 30 plus million on somebody else. That's not the way it works. You want to actually sign players a lot of times that are really expensive that you don't really want because you at least want that asset slot. And a lot of you already know this stuff. The best example of this is Kevin Durant, D'Angelo Russell. It's like, we know we're going to lose Durant. Is there any way we can actually trade him and assign a trade for D'Angelo Russell back? You get Durant, and now we have this asset that we can use later on, which ended up being Wiggins and a lottery pick, right? So the Nets, even though the Kyrie experience hasn't been great, dude doesn't play in a ton of games. He's played in 103 of the available 226 games. The Nets would like to keep him because it's better than just losing him for nothing. Now, would they keep him and do a sign and trade? Let's cover up some of the teams that were talked about here, which I... You know, we'll get to kind of some of the motivation behind a piece of news a little bit later in this open, but any Lakers deal here, yeah, they would do it for Westbrook. No shit. They would do that. They get off of Westbrook. They are convinced the LeBron-Kyrie thing would work. Everything's good. I went on with Cowherd yesterday. He said he'd do Anthony Davis or Kyrie yesterday. I disagreed. Cowherd right now has got me on the AD position. His short position, I'm freaking out about it. I'm still long Anthony Davis. The reason I still wouldn't do it is because at least Anthony Davis wants to play basketball. And the reason he doesn't play is because he's hurt all the time. Although some would argue, hey, he hasn't picked up a basketball in 2 months. Does he really want to play basketball that much or so? Hey, I'll just end it this way. Go ahead. You can have Kyrie. Enjoy. All right. The Knicks part of this seemed weird because the Knicks could get the cap space to go ahead and do this. They could also trade some pieces, but you would have to do a combination of moving off of Evan Fournier's $18 million and $18.9 million guarantee. There's a team option on a third year from now on the 4 years of the overall deal. Alec Burks, who I actually kind of like a little bit, but he's $10 million with a team option next year. Nerlens Noel's $9.2 million with a team option. Kemba's $9.1 million. So you could maybe attach some assets, but then you're thinking, okay, wait a minute. What are we doing again for the Knicks? We don't want to do a sign and trade. We want to clear enough cap space to just go ahead and take Kyrie. There'll be an awesome headline. We're taking him away from Brooklyn. But we have to probably throw an asset on, maybe a first rounder with Fournier, because everybody knows that we're trying to move it to do something else. Maybe we have to throw on some second rounders here with a combination of the remaining guys, but at least their contracts will be expiring after this season. Do we really want to have to go through all of these mechanisms to, again, sign somebody to a max deal that doesn't seem super interested in playing basketball? And this stuff has been going on for 5 years because it started at 25 years old. And I wonder who would actually think, hey, from 30 to 35 is when he's really going to lock in. Then there's the Clippers part of it where, you know, look, it's a lot easier for them to just go ahead, if he were to opt in, to trade for him because they have some pieces. You know, do you throw a Reggie Jackson out there? Do you throw a Norman Powell in there? You know, this, I think their only draft pick that's remaining to trade is 2028. You know, does any of that make sense? And does it really make sense for a Clippers team that, yeah, best case scenario, Kawhi, Paul George, Kyrie, but you're talking about guys that just are almost never at their best case scenario. So it keeps getting back to like, all right, so this piece of news was what? Was this piece of news somehow presented as, well, if the Nets don't step up and offer the full max, here are these other options? Well, they're super complicated options. And I did think the article was very pro-Kyrie, which I always do with any of these newsy things. I'm like, where's the motivation behind this information? There was a line in there about how Kyrie had helped lead the Nets last year to it wasn't the second round. It was the Eastern Conference semifinals. You're like, also known as the second round. He played in four of those games. I don't feel like Kyrie's led much of any group of dudes to do anything except Durant make a really bad decision for the rest of his career. So you can never rule out the third team, maybe that gets involved to help move these things along. Many mistakes have been made when you're just looking at two teams trying to trade for people and you're like, oh, mysterious third team enters the chat. So that's always a factor in this. But then there's also, wait a minute, if we get these good teams that would want to add Kyrie, maybe there's bad teams that would want to add Kyrie. I actually think bad teams adding him would be even worse than good teams because good teams would have players that he'd actually have to sort of respect. But we thought we just had that with Durant and Harden, and that wasn't the case. Can you imagine Kyrie with a young developing team, him coming in, dropping philosophical bombs on dudes at halftime? So I'm not sure that's a great fit. So look, back to the beginning of this, I know why the Nets are doing this. I know why they'd like to keep the asset. The leverage may actually be with them where they're like, we don't think you want to opt out and just go to salary cap for one of these really bad teams. So we'll just hold off, wait until you opt in, and then we'll figure it out after that. And if it means you play in a one-year deal, it means you play in a one-year deal. And if it means you end up giving in to a version of a contract structure that we feel like protects the team, because again, I don't know, teams get weird that way. They want the guys that they pay to play in games. Fucking mind-blowing, I know. Maybe hit pause and just let that marinate for a second. But I thought it was a really interesting piece, but I'm not sure how. You never rule out anything in this league, but it's just, these are very, let's just say this, it is very complicated. And by the way, Kyrie has not made basketball a priority, so it's hard for me to think there's a ton of teams out there making Kyrie the priority. Double solo segments today. Had a lot going on. I think I had like 7 segments I could have done. I think I could have taped for just straight 90 minutes after Golden State won this whole thing and then another Friday. So I do want to go back to something because I just think it's interesting. And I think it's the new normal and kind of those times where you go like, is this where we are right now? And the question I would ask is, does this mean that every time a team wins a championship, they start pulling receipts and taking their victory lap? Because that's exactly what Golden State did. Again, everybody knows I really like Golden State, so that was sort of a weird series for me. I think Cerruti kind of called me out a little bit where he was basically like, yeah, but you still love Steph, so how pro-Boston are you going to be in this one? It was very weird, but I was really happy to see Steph get this victory lap despite, you know, the team you grow up with and all that kind of stuff. But Clay started it up pretty quick. He called Jaren Jackson Jr. a bum at the podium. Straight up called him a bum. That doesn't happen a lot, folks. Because Jaren Jackson Jr. had tweeted out strength in numbers after they had beaten the Warriors in a playoff game. The Memphis Golden State history now is new. It's new history, but there's some depth there. Memphis bounced him in the playoff game last year. The Iguodala trade where he didn't want to go there. So Dylan Brooks had some interesting comments about that. The Brooks foul on Gary Payton, you know, it was a nasty play. Payton landed the wrong way. It happens. It's not the end of the world. The whoop that trick game, though, I felt like was actually a real moment because I, who likes Memphis, and, you know, Memphis reminds me a little bit like that Thunder team where Durant and Westbrook just were not even remotely afraid of Kobe and the Lakers. Like, just it was one of those great moments where you're watching basketball and you go, oh, wow, this is like a real thing. Like, they're not remotely intimidated by these dudes whatsoever. And I think Memphis certainly has that in their DNA. I wouldn't say they're ever intimidated by it. Ja gets hurt. You know, who knows? Maybe the series could have gone a little different. I don't necessarily think the Warriors were going to lose any version of that series. But there was a real, like, in-your-faceness, which is what Memphis is about, right? The reason we like the rise and grind shit, we like the city and all that kind of stuff. Like, these, but I remember doing the podcast the next day going, I kind of want the Warriors to trash this team now. Because, again, the Warriors ended up being a team that won an NBA championship at one point, being down 55 points in a playoff game. I don't know that that's happened a lot. Where it's like, they're down 55. I still like that team to win the whole thing, though. And maybe that's just been the case where we see some of these blowouts, and we had a ton of blowouts in the playoffs. Where teams are just like, all right, we're out of this. But the Whoop That Trick game felt like something. It didn't make me dislike Memphis. It just made me want them to be kind of reminded about the gap. And I remember Chris Vernon texted me the next day. He's like, you broke my heart today. You broke my heart saying you want to see the Grizzlies get destroyed. But I said it and I felt it because of all of that stuff that I saw. And it just kept going. I mean, Steph did the zero over the eye thing because that was what dudes, I think, on First Take had done at one point, where they were like, how many more titles are the Warriors going to win? And they were all like zero, Perkut in the action as well. And then Draymond just basically let everybody have it. And here's what's funny about it is these are guys that are very important. These are players that are the best in the world at what they do. And they've already had success. So this isn't like new money, man. Their first title was 7 years ago, and they were telling everybody how they felt about all the disrespect, which is very similar to what a lot of us do. As soon as a team wins a title, like, I can think of specific ones where if Clemson had beat LSU in the title game a couple of years ago, Clemson fans, the drafts that you probably had ready to go at me were endless. Here's another one. Like, if the Tennessee Titans had come out of the AFC after I said they were one of the worst one seeds that I think we've seen historically in a really long time, and there were numbers and results to back that up, whatever, it's football. They lost to Cincinnati. I didn't come on the show the next day going like, look at me, I was amazing doubting the Titans, you know, because I also realized there was another version of it that could have gone the other way. But had the Titans made a run, I would have gotten all sorts of Titan fans tweets, because it isn't just enough that your team wins. It's that, hey, my team won. Like, I'm a Braves fan, right? All right, Braves win the World Series. 90 seconds later, I'm going to fire one off here on that fuck Ken Rosenthal. This guy didn't think we had enough bullpen depth. Fuck him. That's what happens. It's like, wait, it isn't that my team, and in some cases in these cities who haven't won for decades, have finally won a championship in this thing that I care so much about. Let me, within minutes, let the doubter know. And so there is a weird correlation there, because if I were a player and I were really good, with the first thing, and again, maybe I shouldn't say it's the first thing because it's the stuff that also made its way out, and I didn't watch every single press conference from the first minute to the last minute, but this felt a little different, but it also didn't feel that different because I think this is kind of the new normal. I don't know that I'll ever accomplish anything in life that'll be like, if I were to do something really special, right? If I don't know what that would be, right? I have some thoughts. Maybe I'm not going to share them anymore. But would I start doing a victory lap about all the people that doubted me? Now, if you listen to me, you're like, dude, you are the number one draft pick of people that would do that. I would 100% think it, right? Like, what if, say, I ended up being the number one sports podcast? Like, would I rip other podcasts? I don't know. I mean, if there was another podcast out there that cut their podcast into a million pieces, then made me look bad at work, and then did some victory lap about how they were the best the whole time when they weren't, would I ever call that out? I don't know that I would do that, right? Because I also don't know that I'll do anything as cool as winning an NBA championship. And if I were winning an NBA championship, would I actually want to take the time to like let everybody know? And here's the thing, is maybe I should stop asking any of this stuff, right? Because this is what it is now. This is what it is because, as I've said for years now, the access to hate has never been greater, right? Some of the LeBron stuff is still silly to me. Like the Wash King thing. Who's actually calling him Wash King, right? He screwed up by having that same energy. And like, yeah, a lot of people did have that same energy that doubted you and they ended up being right. Does it mean that you're going to go, hey, that previous have that same energy tweet, I actually missed on that one. The same energy tweet opinions also seem to always be off the mark a little bit. But the funny thing, if you take it back to the Memphis part of the Golden State part, is that Ja Morant, who again, got eliminated, didn't play in the rest of the series, and then the team they were calling out wins another NBA championship, and Ja goes to the default rent-free line as a comeback to the Warriors. And I'm thinking like, wait, You just get to say rent-free when you got kind of owned for a season? Because that's exactly what happened. Golden State beat you guys. You didn't play in the games. They went on, they won a championship. So like it or not, they get to say all this shit now because the winners write history. And what I always think is kind of funny about, like, hey, I'm wrong. I got called out. So what do I do here? Oh, this guy said something about me. Let me just go to the default rent-free. Rent-free and have that same energy seem to be in that same neighborhood of like tweets that you go, everything that follows this usually isn't that great of an observation. I mean, we talked about some of the hate and the criticism. Fucking Drake is one of what, the five biggest artists in the world? That guy's been bummed out about his friend group for years. All right? So as I've always said, if you want to find the hate, you can find it, right? If you're doing anything that people care about, you can find someone taking a dump on the thing that it is that you do, right? But to see a team win and spend so much time talking about another team, I don't know if that's a Warriors-specific thing. Maybe it is with their personality. Maybe it is with Draymond. I wouldn't say it bothers me. I would just say, hey, I think this is what it is now. And it's going to happen more and more as these younger players get older because they grew up with it, keeping track of everything. And I'll tell you, I'm here for it.
Chances are, though, you're going to be able to find an opinion on any take. Like, even if you're the anti-Giannis takes are the one that you won't find, but pretty much every other take is going to be available for you. So if you think that you're being hated on or you're being disrespected, there's a good chance you can just search something on Twitter. You're going to be able to find what you want, right? But here's why I do think that the Warriors thing is different. It's because you had guys going on morning shows for a couple years talking about, you know, Andrew Wiggins, like, this team, Steph will never make the finals again with this squad. They're done. The dynasty's done, blah, 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 blah. And the emotion for them to get back to this point, I think, is different than in most instances. You know, like the amount of doubt that people threw at them because they wanted this thing to be done. They wanted the Warriors dynasty to be over. And the fact that they got to the top again, I think, adds that much more like validity to their angst, if that makes sense, the Warriors stuff. And let's be honest about the Grizzlies, too. And I don't want to bum Chris Vernon out anymore, but this is a team that I could very easily see us turning on quickly in a couple of years if they don't start winning some stuff, because they have a lot of guys that like to talk. Ja's been very vocal on Twitter. Obviously, the Jaren Jackson tweet was bad. I think this was like a perfect storm of two teams, and it doesn't mean that Memphis was living rent-free in Golden State's head. It just means that you said a stupid thing and you got called out for it after that team won the title. So usually I'm very anti, like, you know, hey, we just won something, let me talk about my haters, but I actually thought it was kind of validated in this instance.
Okay, so I like what you did there, because I think it's two things. I think it's the new normal, but I also think it's a heavy Warriors thing too. So you're right. The only part of the jaw thing, the rent free, I feel like everybody does that now. Like, oh, whatever. Like, if I responded to one guy who I'll never meet or think about the rest of my life, just because I'll say, hey, maybe that day I want to respond to somebody, and the guy gets to say, oh, rent free, bro. Rent free. And you're like, well, now the Warriors did talk about them a lot. But that's why I kind of made fun of some of the, I'm here for it, keep that same energy.
My favorite term. Yeah.
Louder for the people in the back. Yeah.
Just the rotating 3 to 4 things that everyone uses all the time.
Good morning to Usman Jang and Usman Jang only.
Yeah.
Just whenever I see keep that same energy or rent free, I'm like, yeah, actually, I'm not going to agree with you.
But here's
I'm not going to agree with you.
Here's the thing too. Even if Clay was thinking about that tweet for months, they won the title. If he used that as motivation, then it fucking worked. So good for you. Yeah, like it doesn't work. Like, even if you are rent free in Clay's head, guess what? He just proved you wrong because he won the chip. Like, that's all that matters. So the fact that he used that as motivation and then actually did win a title, to me, that you're not poning him by saying living rent free. You just gave him motivation and he did it. So I don't think we should be criticizing that at all.
Rent-free or keep that same energy, or kind of like anybody that's ever played baseball where the third base coach is giving you the signs and then it's the belt grab is the indicator that a real sign is coming.
Yeah.
So like whenever I see rent-free or keep that same, I'm like, oh, this will be a terrible part of the argument.
Yeah.
Or in Ja's case, like, you know, like, they won, man. They won. They won the argument. They won the series. They won the title. And so you can say rent-free, but you don't really have, like, nope, not too many people are really like, you know, Ja, great point, dude. Great point.
Are you with me on the Grizzlies thing, though? Like, I think if they don't take another step, or if they don't get to where we where like they're projected to go, which is probably finals in the next couple of years based on how much they talk and how, you know, how much we like the team to watch. But we do this with every team. As soon as you don't reach a goal or achieve or keep that linear progress going, we kind of turn on you. I could see 2 to 3 years like them being the most hated team in the league easily.
Most hated.
They just have a lot of young guys that, I mean, Dylan Brooks, Jaren Jackson Jr. and Ja alone. That's a tough trio if you're not winning, you know, if you're not winning titles. Like, at least Draymond win. Like, Draymond, yeah, okay, it's tough, but like, he's a winner. He's won 4 championships. There's not much you can say about him. Like, you can still not like him, but you got to respect him. If this Grizzlies team doesn't start winning, and I know they're still really young, we've got time, but this is what we do. We just turn on teams like this. We love them when they're young, and as soon as they don't win after a couple years and they don't kind of keep that linear progress going, we're like, who the fuck are these guys talking so much back? They haven't won anything. Look, it's 0 titles. And then, you know, that's kind of how it works.
I would rather them be them the way they are now, though, than a young team that thinks they're young. You know, I would rather this, even if there was that moment in the playoffs where I was like, I kind of wanted the old school Warriors to put it on them. And look, they ended up, you know, they didn't destroy him, but they beat him. They moved on in the series. But I would still rather Memphis maintain who they are in this group. But you're absolutely right. Because, you know, if you're quiet and not good, no one cares. When you're loud and not good enough, that's when you bring that attention to yourself. Yeah. And I'm here for it. This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwich is done right, can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Excited to talk to this head coach in the NBA. It's Chris Finch of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And the reason I wanted to do this, and, you know, look, I've wanted to do this for a while here, is when I ran into you in Chicago, too, I go, you know, look, we get plenty of stuff wrong, but it was a Timberwolves team. You know, you come in February of last year. They were 13-40. They finished 10-9. The end of the year can be a little misleading, but I just felt like something clicked, and then you make the playoffs this year. So can you talk about the beginning of you starting the head coaching gig, your first one in the NBA, and then, you know, losing games, maybe some things changing, and whatever it was, having it carry over to a playoff season for you?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously kind of unique circumstances parachuting in the middle of a season. And what I really tried to focus on, like, break things out into things I could change, you know, in the short term, things that I could maybe impact over the medium term, and things that I couldn't change until we got to the off season. And I just thought the first thing I said about was just figuring out how to get the team to compete more, like helping them understand like what that means, you know, compete when they're fighting through a screen, compete when they're getting back in transition, like all the little pieces, break it down for them and just try to be way more competitive. While at the same time building up their confidence, because the team just really had struggled with its confidence, as you can imagine any team going through that type of losing would. Then we looked at changing our defense, and that over, you know, little bit by little bit over the medium term, we were able to kind of, you know, we weren't anywhere good, but we were still a little bit more resistance. We moved from playing into a very conservative drop oriented defense to a extremely aggressive fly around attack the ball style, which I felt suited just, you know, younger athletes trying to, you know, figure it out in the NBA, like just take the thinking out of it, be more attack minded. And then that little body of work we were able to take into the summer and kind of really use it as a, you know, we had a proper body of work to evaluate what we thought we could and couldn't do. And last summer was a lot about reconstructing our defense, keeping that same attack mindset, but putting a little bit more structure, a little more rules with it, and then figuring out pick and roll coverages, et cetera, that best suited our guys. And that's where we had the biggest jump. I mean, and we still have a lot of holes in our defense. Some of the things that you want to do better, need to do better, such as like transition and rebounding. Those are two huge drivers. But, you know, we were able to generate a lot of turnovers, and that was probably the key to our defense. Just also kind of, you know, continuing to fly around and use our length and athleticism. Offensively, you know, I felt looking at the roster coming in that we had all the skills we needed. You know, just how do you like blend them together? I think our three guys, D'Angelo, Carl, and Anthony, they all have complementary skill sets. It's not like they're all trying to compete in the same space, do the same thing with the ball. So I thought that gave us a great chance right there. You know, and then I had the benefit of those guys being able to play together longer. You know, Ryan Saunders, my predecessor here, he just, you know, had so many injuries and they really didn't have a chance to kind of gel and figure it out. So I think, you know, as important as the start of this season and the offseason was, the last 20 games for us last year when we had all three guys being able to play with, you know, that gave us the best insight of how good we felt we could be coming into this season.
I imagine all the years, you know, we're talking a couple decades here as an assistant, different stops, and you're thinking about your philosophy. Like, hey, I want everybody to move off the ball. I want guys rescreening. I want early transition, kind of semi-transition threes. I want to fight over. I don't want to give up switches all the time. You right. know, I want guys. And then you get the players, you're like, hey, some of these guys just don't want to do that. Like,
right, like, yeah.
how hard is that, realizing that your magic application of basketball philosophy is not always a realistic application?
Yeah, great question. I think as you prepare for jobs, you know, you always do so pretty much like in idyllic conditions or in a vacuum. Fortunately, I've been in a lot of scenarios wherever I've coached where there's been so much change and so much stuff out of your control. I kind of just learned to roll with it a little bit. You know, coaching in the G League was a master class in that. Like, your roster's changing all the time. So you have to still maintain the high level principles, the philosophy, and the things that you believe in, but you have to pick a different route to get there. You know, you can still value the same shots, but some of the concepts that you use to get to them might change, because your best player one day was your point guard. He leaves. Now your best player happens to be a skilled four. You're not going to keep doing the same things you did for the point guard with a lesser talented player in that role now. So I think key for us was, you know, we built a real diverse staff here. I brought in to help run the defense was Elston Turner. Elston's been in the league long, long time. He's been with Mike D'Antoni, done volume switching. He's been with Rick Adelman, you know, where they didn't switch a ton at all. You know, he's been with Dave Yeager, who's like highly touted defensive tactician. A lot about, you know, game planning. He's been with a lot of really good offensive-minded coaches too, which I think was important because, you know, you don't get into that turf war where the things we choose to do offensively are going to obviously impact some of your defense too, and vice versa. Which I've been in, you know, around some staffs that you had this flashpoint where, you know, it caused a little bit of friction.
I was asking around prior to this interview some guys that have worked with Diego, give me a Finch scouting report. And they were like, one of the coolest things that he had said to them, and I'm not going to name the person, but it's a compliment, so don't worry about it. They're like, that you felt as an assistant, you had to be the opposite of the head coach's personality, right? So like a little good cop or a bad cop, depending on how that works. How does that change once it becomes, now do you no longer have to pretend?
Yeah. You know, I think as coaches, we have to be whatever our team isn't, you know, whether it's your head coach, you need to compliment him and whatever. I mean, I have blind spots and what I'm able to do as a coach and my personality, and I need assistants that help me. You know, as a team, if you have a team who doesn't have a lot of leadership. We talk about this, like, you know, every coach will bemoan, we don't have enough leaders. We don't have enough. Well, isn't it our job to provide that leadership for them in some capacity? Like, aren't we supposed to fill these, you know, these deficiencies? If we're not tough, like, you know, we can be tough minded as a staff, and our, you know, hopefully our team figures out how to be a little tougher, you know? But yeah, so I was always very lucky to work for coaches who gave me a big platform on the offensive side of the ball. Kevin McHale, Alvin Gentry, Nick Nurse, these guys, Mike Malone. I mean, all the guys I worked for gave me a big platform. Alvin and Mac in particular, you know, they were player coaches. They spent most of their time with player relationships. So in a lot of that, those roles, I ended up having to be the bad cop too, just because, you know, when you're running the offense or you're running the defense, accountability in the film room begins and ends with you. You know, the coach has your back, which is hugely important. But so, you know, moving into the head coaching realm, I just wanted to empower my assistants and have their back, and also, you know, set the tone and set the environment, you know, what our behaviors are expected to be.
Let's talk about your players. I don't know when it was, but there was just a moment with Anthony Edwards where this year I went, okay, this feels like the start of something really special. There's a lot of great young players that are sick athletes that can score 20 a game and take over games. But I just ask you, you're around him every day. How special can he be?
Yeah, very. I mean, we think he can be certainly a high-level franchise player, perennial all-star. Some of the things that he's done at an early age are things that only those types of players do. He needs to obviously become more consistent in a lot of things. He's still trying to figure out a lot. The great thing about Anthony is he knows who he is and who he isn't. He is very, very mature and very self-aware. And through that process, like, he understands the value of playing with a guy like Karl Anthony Towns, who can space the floor so he can live in the paint. You know, like, he's not trying to fight to be the number one guy at any point in time. He just believes it's going to come, you know, as he gets older and better. I was a little worried about going into the playoffs about how he might try to do too much. And sometimes that stage might swallow you up. But I mean, he took to it easy, and he was comfortable. He was confident. He was loving it. You know, he never really played in a basketball game of that magnitude anywhere, you know, certainly not in college and certainly not before that. So, and it's when I watch him go through these things, whether it be scoring 40 or playing well in the playoffs or dominating a quarter or finishing out how to close games, that's, I realize I'm watching somebody who has an incredibly high ceiling. So it's fun to be able to work with him. What I love about him is he's really, really coachable. And that's what gives us the best hope that he's going to be this high-end talent that can drive winning for a long time for this franchise.
Is there any similarity, a lesson learned from a previous stop in the NBA where you had somebody that was really special and you're thinking about that timeline and applying that to Anthony?
Yeah. So maybe a little less about the timeline, but more about the experiences that the evolution of it, I guess, is that, you know, when I work with James Harden, when he came to Houston, you know, James would see so many different looks, and particularly in the playoffs, you know, we'd get a lot of different looks in the playoffs that maybe he hadn't seen in the regular season. And then we'd have to figure out how to solve them, or he'd have to figure out how to solve them, work on it. Next year, he'd come back. And I think Anthony, like, we're seeing these looks coming at him, like, in the regular season now. You know, a lot more game planning, a lot more different looks that he's have to process. And I think partly because I think, you know, teams in the league now are just way more flexible defensively than they've ever been, so they're able to kind of shift game to game. You know, whereas 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you did less of that. You kind of set out your stall. This is what we are. This is who we are. And then the playoffs will change. But now we see so many different looks. So helping Anthony work through those, certainly drawing upon our experiences with James.
Is Karl Anthony Towns, like, does the whose team is it stuff, does that matter? I'm sure some guys it matters. Does it matter with you?
I don't get a sense that it matters at all. I think Kat has, I know Kat has embraced Anthony. Anthony, as I said, understands the value of playing with a guy like Kat. He also knows that Kat is the best player on our team. Kat, you know, understands that he needs help. You know, all players need to have great players around him. I think it's one of the signs of maturity for young players. They come in the league looking to prove themselves, particularly these high picks, prove themselves, make their mark, grow their brand, get paid, all the things that they want to do. And they always think they can do it alone or damn near alone. But the reality is none of them can. Nobody can. And so then they start to realize that, how hard it is to be the only guy out there. And this, you know, so adding talent. And I once heard when I got into the league, like, and it always resonates with me, is that what superstar players need most is hope. They need hope. They need hope coming that they have good enough teammates, good enough coaches, good enough organization, and a good enough environment to be able to maximize their potential. And I think Kat understands, you know, how good and special Ant can be.
I'll just admit it. D'Angelo Russell's been a tough watch for me over the years. And I know you're not dumb enough to sit there and be like, no, I totally get it. No, like, you're his head coach. I thought he made some real strides this year, you know, and kind of understanding how he fit in everything. I think a lot of it, it's not the talent. I think sometimes with him, it's the decision-making, kind of what do we need and when do we need it? And then in the playoffs, it wasn't great again. When you're going through film, when you're looking at things that everybody needs to approve, how has the D'Angelo Russell relationship grown with you in just, you know, a year and a half?
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, I agree. For me, I can only judge my experience with a player, and D'Lo's been great. Like, he's been super receptive, since very coachable, very bought in. I think his impact on our success sometimes was overlooked this year, particularly in the first half of the season, defensively, where he was very impactful off the ball as a help defender. Very smart player. I think trying to figure out those three guys offensively, we thought it would be a little easier out of the chute, but I think everybody started the season with so much ambition that they're all trying to put their mark on things. That had to play out a little bit. We had to figure out some kinks there, but we got it sorted. He had some really big games, and the play-in game was probably a signature game for us this year. And he had a few of those. But he's been locked in and committed, and work ethic's been great. No problems with him all. He's a basketball junkie. He loves to watch hoop, talk hoop, everything. He's probably our biggest basketball, student of the game, if you will. Like, he's really, really into watching games. So, and last year when I first got here, we watched more film together. This year I didn't have enough time to sit down and watch enough film with him. But yeah, I think for him, his skill set fits perfectly between Ant and Kat. One of the best passers I've ever been around. I keep pushing him to just keep leaning into that. Really good shot maker, particularly in the clutch. And for sure, with all these guys, like, shooting sometimes comes so easily to them that they think they'll make any shot. He plays with great confidence. You know?
You mentioned the leadership part before. And I had Jim Peterson on earlier this season, and I just went like, hey, give me the Pat Bev experience, because, you know, it's not for everybody.
Right.
But I feel like any team that has real aspirations needs somebody who's on edge all the time. And it may drive even his own team crazy at times, but how important is he for a guy that's been around and seen a lot to kind of counteract the youth and talent you have on the team?
Yeah. You know, very, very, very instrumental to our environment this year was Pat. Not just what you see, and that's, you know, real. And like you said, it's might not be for everybody. Doesn't bother me. I've known Pat since we came in the league with us in Houston. One of the things I love about him is that he still maintains that chip on his shoulder to prove to himself that he belongs, even though he clearly does, and how that drives him. The most important things for what he does for our environment or did coming in this year are things that you don't see. Like, he's an extremely good professional in terms of how he does his work every day, looking after his body, keeping his game sharp, teaching a young team what professional habits look like, making sure that even though it's an optional off day or a get what you need day, that everyone's still coming in and they're still doing their work, that they're locked into the game plan. He'll send them text the night before with some insight on guys that he knows from playing against these guys in the league for so long. In the film room, not afraid to, get on guys or clean up a message that may be a little bit blurry or something like this. So it's a lot of the stuff you just really don't see. And the stuff that you do see is stuff that gives a young team confidence that they're willing, that they, and it also ups the ante. Like, if that guy's going to play that hard, then I got to go out there and play that hard, So I'm a big PB fan, maybe not such a fan of his media tour at the moment, but
I was going to ask, I would be worried that he'd be on First Take and they do a Timberwolves blame pie and Pat Bev would be like, well, 51% on Coach Finch. Let's start there.
That's fine. I'll take it. I'd rather be blaming me and get me mad than some of our opponents out there.
Do you guys actually care about the media tour, or is it just like,
I joke with him about it a little bit. I mean, it doesn't bother me. Like, you think because he says something, some team wants to beat us more than they wanted to beat us before? I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I always kind of think that stuff's kind of funny. It's like, wait, so you needed me to get you to try harder? Like, what
exactly?
Then you should be paying me. Mentioned it at the top, and it is something I wanted to kind of round out the interview because there's still a little background stuff that I wanted to do. When you got this gig, everybody was mad at you. And I don't know how many people knew you. And I remember, I'm telling you, I got a few texts from people that had worked with you and they were like, look, I know this is non-traditional. And for those who forget, you were on the Toronto staff and you come over, you get the head coaching gig after Saunders is out. Usually somebody on the assistant side is bumped up interim, and Minnesota was just like, we don't want to do this. We want to go ahead and grab Chris Finch. And it's worked out. It was the right call, which I don't think too many people have come back around on and admitted they didn't like the way you got the job. What was that like for you, realizing a lifelong dream and then so many in the media that didn't even know who you were dumping on the decision?
Yeah. Well, it didn't really change what it meant for me internally. My moment was always going to be my moment. It wasn't the moment that I really needed to have validated by the rest of the world. The circumstances were certainly unusual. I didn't really see some of the backlash coming. To be fair, I didn't necessarily think it was, I didn't take it personal. My fellow coaches reached out to me when the Coaches Association put out the statement that they did. They made sure to reach out to me that it wasn't personal against me. It was more reflective of the processes, which I understood. I understood the sensitivities around it. When I came in, I talked. One of the first things I did, I sat down with David Vanderpool. I just said, hey, man, I know this sucks for you. It really does. And let's just try to work through it. And, he was awesome. He was really, really good for us. Good for me for the remainder of the season. So, and he's an outstanding coach and he deserves his chance. And hopefully at some point he'll get his chance. That's just the thing. There's only 30 of these jobs. They're really, really hard. I take zero credit for what, happened after, but there was then we all looked, every team in the hiring process looked at the way they were doing business. And there was a rush of hiring minorities last summer, African-Americans into head coaching roles, which is great, great for the game. So, I guess you can say that it all worked out better because of the way the hiring process has been evaluated. And again, I take no credit for that. But if that's what happened after it, then I think we can all feel a little bit better.
Let's go back to your playing career. You're coming out of Franklin and Marshall. you end up in England.
Yeah.
I know they were the Sheffield Forgers based on the steel industry. And then you got moved up. It sounded like you had a lot to do with going up in the division. And I also talked to Nick Nurse about this, but I'm always kind of, because I'm still somewhat mindful of where I was at as a guy leaving college and knowing how incredibly disappointed my family was for a little while. Were they like, hey, what's the plan, man? You're just playing in England for 5 years? Like, do you actually think you're going to play in the NBA at some point? Take us through these years, which can be great years looking back. In the moment, we don't realize how great the delaying of real life is for those of us that delayed it. But those around us usually aren't as supportive.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, when I knew I wanted to become a coach and when I was leaving college, like, my parents were pretty supportive. They didn't really give me too much grief. Ironically, one of those moments in life where I was offered a graduate assistant job at the same day, very much the next day, I believe it was, to go over and play professionally in England, which I knew nothing about, you know. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to try this. If nothing else, it's a life experience for a year. And then 1 year became 17, just how it all unfolded. I always wanted to coach, but I never thought I'd coach in the NBA. It was never, you know, I think if you talk to Nick, you know, Nick was, we coached over there at the same time. We went through an extremely similar path, but he was probably always a little bit more like ambitious in that he knew where he wanted to go. I was just trying to like be really good where I was. And I didn't think I'd ever get back to America. I didn't have any kind of contacts back here in the NBA game, being from a small college. So my sights were far more set on just being in the European game, trying to get to Spain, get to Russia, get to some of these Turkey, get to Greece, some of these bigger leagues.
What was your favorite place that you lived overseas?
I mean, London. I have to say London. We would live in London for the summers during the national team.
Because I know Germany probably wasn't a great experience, right? Maybe you just weren't there long enough. What's it like to get fired after 17 games in Germany?
Yeah. Not a lot of fun. But I mean, that's the European basketball is the Wild West. Like, if you lose to the wrong team, you're out. You know, you lose two games in a row, you're out. Sometimes it's extremely emotional. I mean, we think right now in America, there's no patience, you know, and owners have no patience. But over there, they might not have patience, but like, they have this burning desire to do something. Those are club structures. So you have a lot of like outside money, almost like a college, influencing what the club does. You know, like, people are saying, we got to do something. Coach got to go, or we got to do something. Nick will tell you he went to practice one day and they changed his Americans and didn't tell him, you know, like, this is the type of environment that you're coaching in. So, but I was always lucky and fortunate to be in pretty sane situations over there where I was able to like kind of establish roots and grow a career. But yeah, so I went to a club that, I guess at the time in Germany, there were 16 teams. We probably had the 14th biggest budget. But they had won championships in the 80s and they still thought they were that team, which is the type of team you never want to coach for. You never want to coach for this team that's still living in the glory days. I remember my boss telling me, well, we don't tell the board members that we have the 14th largest budget. I said, well, don't you think that would help around here? Like, they set expectations. He said, no, it would be an insult if we told them that. I was like, well, tell them to put more money in, you know?
How do you take all of your experiences, right? And as you said, you're almost two decades over there. And then, you know, you get to Houston and you've been on some really good staffs. And now you're finally head coach. You know what I mean? Like, this took a while. You even just said, like, this isn't necessarily what you envisioned. And you have this team with these really good young players and you get a real taste of what the playoffs are about. You lose to Memphis. How do you turn that into like, let's not be happy to be here because we took that first step of many? Because that first step is really hard. Like, how much work is put into, and again, it's not like kids, so you don't want to keep telling them over and over again to be focused for next year. But the concern is just the delicate nature of sports, and that is like, let's not be content here. Let's be motivated by what kind of improvement we've made as an organization.
Yeah, so great question. And that basically strikes at the heart of what our offseason is about. You know, I keep preaching to the guys that this has to be the foundation for us to move forward from. It can't be the finish line. You know, we got to make sure that we learn from, you know, we were the more immature team. Memphis was the more mature team. Like, we have to find that maturity. They're a great team. They're on the verge of becoming an even better team. And they've kind of been through the fire a little bit if you look at their previous seasons. But more importantly, like, when we come back to work, we have to go all the way back to the beginning and build it all the way back up. We're not going to just resume where the season finished for us. That's not how it works. You know, you got to go back and lay the right foundation with the right habits and the right standards, right expectations. And, you know, quite honestly, that has me a little bit concerned at times because we have a very young team and they've not experienced a lot of success in anywhere in their careers. You know, these guys oftentimes are in college for 1 year. There's not even a year that they can go back and build off in college. Like, everything is a new start for them. So it's really important that we understand that it's not going to happen just because it happened before, and we got to get better. And the West is going to be, you know, tougher if everybody gets healthy out here in the West.
It was a fun team to watch this year. I know that's not the ultimate goal, but, you know, from the previous seasons of, like, all right, Minnesota's on. I don't know who else is on. Minnesota became one of my go-tos this season. And, you know, I know it's the players, but you did have something to do with it as well. So thanks a lot for the time, all right?
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice, lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. We have a bunch of follow-ups on previous topics. There was a couple that I actually really liked. So, let's do this one. Regarding giving away stuff as a bartender, I think we kind of, after spending way too long on that, which is almost the case for all these answers, let's not kid ourselves. I was kind of like, if you have a good relationship with the owners or the managers or whatever, and you do it within reason where you're, you know, discounting a few guys, it's not the end of the world. Some people are completely philosophically opposed. And again, if you're doing some of the more updated point of sale registers and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, you're working for a chain or whatever, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I think it's going to work out. So anyway, there's a story about a bartender down in New Orleans pre-Katrina. There was a bar around the corner from the newspaper that I worked at. Oh, excuse me. I don't think they're in New Orleans, but they're in Mississippi. Okay. So around the corner from the newspaper I worked at, we hang out after we put out the paper. So putting the paper to bed, newspaper term. Some of you journalists get it. Obviously, we got to know the bartenders, managers, and owners pretty well. There was this one bartender named Dave, and you could drink and drink and drink when he was working, and you get an $8 tab. He knew we'd take care of him with a tip. So this one manager, Dan, who was my best friend at that place, knew what Dave was doing, and he'd tell the owners, "Hey, Dave is robbing you guys blind here." The owners would respond, "What are you talking about? Everybody loves Dave." And Dan would say, "Of course they do. He's robbing you blind." After about a year of this, he finally got them to install some cameras around the bar to keep tabs. Dave lasted about a week after that. So they just wanted to send a shout out to old $8 Dave. Where no matter what, Kyle. Yeah.
Took him down.
I love the, "What are you talking about? Everybody loves this guy." $8 Dave, man.
Wait, so one of the patrons went to the owner? Right? That's what he said.
That sounds like, hey, Kyle, that sounds like somebody in school going, "Hey, you forgot to give us homework, huh?"
Yeah. Do your own work, pal. All that stuff.
Is he looking for a job too? Jeez. It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know if this is, people are asking me to run the Print the Shirts Part 2 segment that we cut after Marcus Smart fucking rolled on Steph's ankles and it was my open and ready to go the next morning, full of passion and confidence, where I was like, "I'm going to get in front of this." I don't know. I think I have enough of an ego and confidence that I don't need to run a segment we didn't run a week after the Warriors won the title, proving, "Hey, look at me."
Is that technically receipts at that point? Do you have receipts on that technically? Because I mean, got it somewhere in the bowels of my Dropbox.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to run that. I think it just sounds like I just need to. That's a self-check where I was like, yeah, maybe I should run that. I'm like, why? Just so I feel cool.
I mean, a lot of other dudes would definitely run that. a lot of other people would definitely run that.
That's for the Patreon, right?
Again,
there.
I'll mention the morning shows again. That would be in heavy rotation on a couple morning shows this morning.
Look, I didn't run it. I'm oozing with confidence the last couple weeks. Yeah. I don't need it. I don't need any more. I'm good. There was somebody else asking about the old Adam Sandler producer story. This guy's checking at 6'5", 220. I could dunk at 205, but not since then. Wait, so you can't dunk at 220, 6'5", man? Don't let this go. Don't let this go. There's a couple beasts behind your lower, behind your kneecap. They're just waiting to be unleashed. I'm telling you, man, once I figured out some of the working out stuff, I was hanging on the rim again at 46. I'm 46 now. I always forget my age now. That's great. All right. So this isn't much a question as asking advice, but just out of general curiosity, I'd listen to you and SVP back in the day. I remember a segment you did around 2015, where you told a story about where you blasted Adam Sandler and his quality of movies in front of one of his main producers. I can't recall all the details, so please fill in any gaps here. I remember being a funny story, but not one the producer was able to easily bounce back from. Anyway, I watched Netflix movie Hustle, which stars Sandler, which was produced by LeBron and Maverick Carter. By the way, it's pretty good. Like, I was like, you know what? This is good. This is really good. They did a good job with it. Sandler's fucking, when Sandler's really good, he's fucking awesome.
I went into that movie kind of thinking I wasn't going to like it. And afterwards, I was like, that was kind of dope. That was kind of dope. So yeah, shout out to Mo Wagner.
A good chunk of the movie centers around a Spanish basketball player that Sandler's character finds and trains in preparation for the NBA Combine. Given your tenured experience at the Combine, as well as your Hollywood aspirations, I was half expecting to see you in the movie until I remembered your potential beef with Sandler. Did that prevent me from getting in? Again, to back it all up here, I was at the Greenwich Film Festival on a panel, and they were asking us why they thought so many sports movies got made. And I said, because honestly, there's a formula where if there's an early buy-in with an audience, as I've experienced too, like almost everything you do, like I wrote a true story about something that really happened for a movie. And one of the first meetings I took on it, the guy's like, where's the IP? Like, what happened with this? I'm like, well, I researched it and I know the family and this is what happened and it's super fucked up. And the guy's like, great script, great idea, great execution, but there's no IP. I'm like, other than the fact that it exists and I'm telling you who the people, we can meet him. I can show you court documents. I can show you pictures of all this stuff. But since there wasn't like a book about it or there wasn't something else, there was no IP. So what happens a lot of times, and I'm not saying it's impossible, but if there isn't some sort of existing thing that there's already a buy-in from the audience because audiences are tough, that's why we get so many of these remakes all the time. So I had said, not only a shorter version of this on the panel, I would say, hey, look, like the Sandler movies. I'm like, it doesn't really matter what they do. There's just this automatic buy-in because it's Sandler and there's a formula. I was like, I guess they crush overseas. I was like, but Pixels? I said something like that. And his producer, like his main dude, Jack, was in the audience. And so the woman who I've known since I was a teenager that set up the Greenwich Film Festival pulled me aside. She was like, hey, you're awesome. And she's great, lifelong friend. Although I don't think I've talked to her in 5 years, so let's probably not call her a tier one person. Yeah. As I'm saying, lifelong friend, I'm like, you actually haven't fucking talked to her in like 5 years. So what are you kidding yourself? But she is great. And she was like, hey, great job. Real quick though. She's like the after party. And the after party was at some sick sports car dealership in Greenwich. And I just remember, because I've told this story before, Tashara and I like went downstairs and started looking at cars together. And I was like, yeah, Tashara can take like two of these right now if you wanted to. And she goes, hey, we're going to the after party thing. She's like, Sandler's producers in the audience. So she's like, the comment's not going to be great. And I was like, yeah, fuck. I was like, that's not great. And so then I just went over to him and I was like, hey, man. He's like, hey, you know, like he just immediately had this look on his face like this dick. And then he gets it funnier because he was like, oh, and then he was kind of nice. By the way, Pixels wasn't good. So I wasn't necessarily wrong about some of the premise on some of the other movies, even though everybody loves Sandler. And Sandler, by the way, is considered the number one draft pick of anybody that's ever done the celebrity car wash at ESPN. Of anyone the thousands of people that have gone through that place, if you'd ask the talent department who's the best single guy they've ever had to deal with, it's always Adam Sandler. So I was like, hey, yeah, I'm actually probably leaving ESPN soon and I'm headed out to LA to, you know, work on some scripted stuff. And he looked at me like, if you think I'm going to be any kind of contact for you after what just happened, like you're the dumbest guy here. And I just was like, I wasn't doing it thinking like, hey, that's a great idea. I love that idea. Let's connect once we're out there. And so, yeah, I felt like a dick. I didn't feel wrong. And I think that has nothing to do with me not being involved in Hustle, because they had plenty of other higher profile people that were already involved in Hustle. And they did a good job with the sports movie, which I think the hit rate on sports movies is probably like
low.
Less than 10% seems harsh. Let's just say less than 25%. So good job.
A lot of blind sides out there. I will say, though, if you look at the timeline of events, one, you're not wrong. And I think Sandler, if he and his producer can't admit that they have a formula and that's kind of their deal, and they can't think that they're making like Oscar level movies. They're just making Netflix movies. It's fine. But if you look at the timeline of events after that, what happened? Uncut Gems, Hustle. So maybe you got in his head and they kind of, you know, they changed course. They altered plans. Like you planted the seed for the like this the pivot in Sandler's movie making life. And now it's been for the better. So I'll give
so
you
so I am the Jaren Jackson Jr. to
correct.
Sandler.
Correct. You were the career. Motivation. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Rent free, bro. Rent free.
What's up?
Okay. We had a million of these kind of follow-up-y things. So I figured we touched on a couple of those there. But I've told that. So Rudy, you are now on alert. I can never tell that story again because I've already told it a couple different times. But shout out to Hustle because it's good. Check it out on Netflix. So look at this. We're doing
Wancho.
Oh, here's why I wanted to stay on this. Because Matt checked in and says, it's a Canadian Grand Prix this weekend. Shout out to Verstappen and Red Bull. God, Verstappen's the best. Can you see how the woman with the creepy old man dad is doing? Remember that the girl brought her dad to the Montreal Grand Prix, mm-hmm. and she was like, he won't stop checking out women the whole time.
Who may have overreacted about that? I mean, we don't know exactly what was going on. She may have overreacted. Who knows?
Was that your advice? Was that your position at the time, Kyle?
No, I think my position at the time was stupid, but like it could have worked. It was like so crazy it just might work was sort of my thing. Was like,
I think
what
you
if
said be her, be the wingman, right?
Wasn't no, that your not thing? The like, wingman, but I was just sort of like, you know, you see all those videos of like old men partying with like college age girls and like the girls think it's hilarious. The guy's having the best time. I was like, why can't we do that instead of just having him lurking in the corner somewhere or waiting in the beer line? I was like, hey, what if you just go sit down at one of those cafeterias and see what happens? That's what I said.
There was a lot of let him live feedback.
Yeah. It sounds like she was like ruining her own time and his time. So it was like, you might as well just enjoy the race, guys.
All right. So that segues in perfectly into two that we'll do here. Do I tell my friend about his creepy dad? 5'10, 185, 445 squat, 315 clean. Hey, guys, checking in with a dilemma about my friend's creepy dad. I have a buddy. Let's call him. Everybody's just saying Chad now all the time. But we're going to call him Chad in this one, too, I guess. Who transferred to our public high school from the local private school halfway through our freshman year. Hey, take it easy on dudes that switch into a high school a little later than everybody else and nobody knows. Okay. Chad and I became really close, but he never made it to the core group because he's a bit socially awkward. We all went up to college and did our own things and he stayed home. Never had much interest in drinking or doing dumb 20-year-old guy things. Nothing wrong with that. Just trying to paint a picture here. We're all 25 now and have moved out of our hometown. Chad still lives at home with his parents and works at our local gym. I went back home for a weekend about 3 weeks ago and was at the gym with Chad. When my sister, 19 years old, called in a panic, she asked if Chad lived at whatever the address was. I said, yeah, why? And she said, apparently, her and a friend were on a walk in the friend's neighborhood and a car had been driving around slowly and following them. They got scared and went back to the friend's house. As they got to the driveway, the car pulled up and a guy said, hey, this is going to sound weird, but I have a son who lives at the address we're talking about and he's looking for some friends if you two want to come over. To which she replied, quote, yeah, that is really weird. And she kept walking. She didn't know that it was Chad's dad at the time. My dilemma is this. Do I tell Chad about his dad? On one hand, I don't want to cause any tension between Chad and me or Chad and his dad. If he was a core guy, I'd have no problem being like, hey, man, what the fuck is this all about? You going to keep your old man on a leash? But since he's a bit socially awkward, that's pretty aggressive. I feel like it would be a really uncomfortable conversation that is easily avoidable. At the same time, if my dad was prowling around the neighborhood following young girls and asking if they wanted to come to my house, I'd probably want to know about it. Okay. Okay.
It's pretty straightforward.
It's so easy.
Yeah. You want to take it, Kyle?
Oh, I'll keep it short. That's so easy. I mean, even if he is socially awkward, he'd be like, hey, he's totally hurting your status in the neighborhood. If you really are hurting for friends, he's definitely telling everyone in a way that will never, ever bring any friends to your door. And if not, might even get you put on some sort of list. So I'd say, yeah, just get it out of the way. Like, hey, we're friends. I know it's been a while. Great to see you. You look great. You look well. Maybe I'll see you around the gym. But hey, your dad's like harassing people. One of them happened to be my sister. And, you know, we just wanted to pass it along to you. That's all. Simple. Done.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that could maybe possibly make you feel better, as weird as this is that if the dad is a little off, he's off because he's trying to like have his son meet people because his son's still living at home and he's doing kind of like a weird thing of like, is my son never going to move out of the house? Is he ever going to meet somebody? Is he ever going to start a family? And he's doing like a really weird, I don't know if you've ever had aggressive parents trying to set you up with anybody. My mother had like a little phase where she tried it. And she was like, okay, this is the worst idea ever. And I was like, yeah, don't even bother. Stop doing this. But she wasn't crazy aggressive about it. She would meet somebody and then she would start talking me up.
Yeah.
And then it would be this whole, yeah, but then it would like be contact info. And I'd be like, you can't be doing that. You can't just give my cell phone number out to people. Like I fucking, I'm on TV, you know?
Wow.
Like people were supposed to laugh. People were supposed to laugh at that.
I thought this was earlier in life. I didn't know this is when you were doing the show back in the day. Wow.
Yeah, there was a little phase there where she thought she had to get her son back in the game. But because there's like, I don't want to be dismissive of how weird this is. So first of all, the easiest thing, as you said, just you got to say something to him. But you could also be saying something to him in a way where it's not my dad's asking 19-year-old girls prowling the neighborhood to come over to his house because he's fucked up. It's that it's a concerned father who's socially awkward himself. The kids, you know, maybe it's just one of those families that just, you know, the parents are sort of socially awkward. And the next thing you know, you get about three weird kids and it happens, you know, and then, you know, he's just thinking like, hey, younger women, you know, looked about the same age as my son. Like, hey, you know, we got juice boxes and stuff and I'm not a weirdo. And, you know, maybe you guys could, you know, we got, you know, fruit roll-ups, some streaming stuff. We got
pools
the Hulu
open.
Free trial going on. You know, we'll throw on, or maybe Netflix. And maybe he knows. He'd be like, you know, don't say Netflix. So there's a way that you can confront him on this, and it's actually the lesser of what the weirdest possible version of this is, which just, again, makes the whole execution of it a lot easier. So I would say something to him. I think his Chad probably knows his dad's already pretty weird if he's doing something like this. We just hope it isn't the weirdest version of how weird this is.
Yeah.
So, okay. Okay. Single guy problems. Last one that we have here. This was a request through a request, but that's okay. We'll make these happen. So he knows what's happening here. 28 turning 29 any day now. Actually today's his birthday. So happy birthday. Yeah. 6 feet, steady 6 feet from the East Coast, DC, closer to hefty, but not exactly big. When I say East Coast, I mean straight out of the Vineyard Vines Country Club catalog, trying to chase a career in sports, which has led to stints in five cities. So I guess it's the same thing, including a year at the greatest Equinox in the South Bay. Shout out to my home gym. Doing a little push pull today myself. Just hoping to be part of the segment's predecessor, Gym Corner. All right, don't get this confused with I'm an active gym goer, though. I have more late night frozen pizzas than days spent in the gym. Have always found it relatively easy to find a guy's crew as I am outgoing and always down for a good time. Obsessed with chasing my career, and it has paid dividends. Yet the one thing that's always missing is a long-term girlfriend. Friends set me up, not limited to friends' parents, including my grandparents once. I used dating apps, friends of friends, and went out at bars, tried the now old school small talk, which has led to too many chasing the night situations. Man, chasing the night. Thing is, you can like hit on 5% of chasing the night and you will continue to chase the night because of the one time in the previous 20 that it worked. Chasing the night, man. Greg Kilborn once said to me, he goes, don't chase the night, Ryan. Don't chase the night. Let the night come to you.
He can say that.
I was like, okay, dude. Anyway, however, seemingly nothing is clicked. Photo attached. My mom tried to set me up in a Macy's the other day over a phone halfway across the country. I wouldn't say the pressure is high, but it's heating up. That's aggressive. That's aggressive. As I continue to stay single, it slowly become nights out with couples and me, which is a lot of fun, but not exactly single guy fun. I really like my friends' girlfriends, their wives. What the fuck, man? No, I'm just kidding. But when we do have guys' night, part of me feels bad because I don't want my friends to get in trouble, but I still want to have a good time. And often they return home in rougher shape than they should, which sometimes reflects poorly on me. Man, you're really beating yourself up here, dude, because your friends go home and they're more hungover the next day because they hung out with you on the guys' nights. You guys aren't even 30 yet.
No, there's something to that, though.
Yeah.
Wait, okay. Take it from here, guys. Jump in.
No, I'll keep it quick. It's just when I come back, a lot of guys have their own life. Like I said, have families, not necessarily had a wedding, but have families. So they got stuff to do. And then, you know, I come home for 2 weeks at a time. So, you know, 3-4 nights out of those 4 weeks, by like the third time I show up, you know, they're like, all right, where the fuck are you guys going tonight? Like, what could you possibly be doing that you didn't get out of your system the last two times in like a nicer way? But I could tell by the end of my trip, they're sort of like, all right, can't wait till this guy gets out of here. So I could see it.
Yeah. It's like, all right, who are you guys going out with tonight? Oh, Mark's going to be there. You know what happens when Mark's around? And then you get that kind of tag on you. And then don't go out with Mark.
I think that's
kind of alluding to. Like he's kind of the guy that is known, not that he's like forcing them to get after it, but they feel like they can get after with him because he's a single guy and they're probably having more fun. And then you become that guy to the wives and girlfriends.
I think everybody could just calm down.
I agree. I'm only home for 2 weeks. I don't need to feel that way. But what can you do?
You never do stuff? All right. So on a recent life advice, you talked about kids, and I definitely want to get there, but it hasn't happened yet. So right now, I just need advice on being the single guy still closer to college while also staying friends with everyone at the next stage. Do I need more single friends, younger, especially when your career only allows small pockets for fun? Not sure I'm ready to throw that away. All right, so here's the deal. What you have done career-wise is very impressive, all right? We're not going to share everything about what you do because we're not going to do that. But looking at this and knowing who this guy is, like, you have been headfirst in your career, and it's very, very hard, like, when you go, I also want this other thing to be really important, right? Isn't there that book, I think I read it, where it was like the one thing, like just focus on the one thing at all times. I'm not very good at that, on the focusing on the one thing, but it usually seems to like the default goes back to the thing that I actually do care about, even if I'm not saying it out loud what I'm prioritizing. The thing I'm prioritizing is the thing that I end up doing the best with because I'm giving it my full attention, even if I think I'm capable of doing 3 or 4 things at the same time. And for men or women who at a young age decide this above everything else, the other stuff is just going to kind of suffer unless you've met somebody who's so on the same page with you, you know, met you before you started this process. Like if I had met somebody who I totally clicked with in my mid-20s and then we're saying, hey, look at this run that we've been on and you've been there for every twist and turn and all that stuff. Like, yeah, okay, then I could do this with somebody else. But having somebody jump into it midway through your pursuits is a little bit more challenging. Doesn't mean it has to be that way, but that's sort of in my experience. So I think there's some similarities here with this. I think you need to start giving yourself more credit for what you've accomplished professionally and worrying less about the other part of it. Because I know it sounds like super cliche to go, hey, it's going to happen. But sometimes it completely surprises you. Sometimes it happens when you don't think it's going to happen, when it sneaks up. But maybe in the times where you have a little bit more downtime, you prioritize it. But the weird thing is that when you start prioritizing the relationship stuff, then you can just give off this weird high energy sort of desperate vibe that is a huge turnoff, which women, for however they're wired, and maybe one day science will share it with the men, they can smell all of it on us all the time. Like they can tell when you're kind of doubting yourself a little bit. They can tell when you're like a little bit more desperate to be into something. They just know, man. They just know. I think we're terrible at picking that stuff up. So you sound like you kind of have a lot of the things figured out, but you're starting to worry. But like 28, 29 is way too young to be worrying about this. It just is. It just is. And I know it doesn't feel that way to you because you've only been 28, 29. And that's the whole point, is like once guys get past these ages, they can look back and have a different feeling on it. But the business that you're in is very, very demanding. It's incredibly demanding. And I don't know. Look, it doesn't mean you have to be single the rest of your life, but I think it's going to be hard for you to have a thing where you now completely prioritize these things above it, because you're still kind of finding yourself in this career that can take like a couple of decades to accomplish. Anything there? I don't know. I don't know that that was all that unique. So
no, I think he seems like he wants more advice though. Like, he seems pretty cool with the timeline of events. He's just asking like, how do I need new friends to also sort of like satisfy this part of my life that I still want to be a young guy and go out and not feel guilty about it, or not be like a fifth or a third wheel every time you're going out. His career is that is such that I'd imagine I'm interested. Like, I wonder if his friends, like all these close friends he talks about, because he's moved around a lot. He was in Boston, he was in LA, now he's somewhere else. It seems like he's been in a bunch of different places and he's probably made friends. So I wonder if all these people with wives and girlfriends are in his current state, or if they're people that are out of state or in his past that he's like trying to keep up with. Because if you're in a new spot and, you know, you work in a cool, in an industry where I think it's probably, you're right, your time is pretty constricted, but you know, you're around a lot of decently young people and you can kind of go out and you can kind of have a cool job. You can kind of flex that, probably make some friends that way. That's the way I would do it. Don't be afraid of, you know, I'm not saying chase the night all the time, but like, don't be afraid to make some new friends in your new spot, because I don't think your old friends are going to be mad at you for that. And they're going to understand that you're in a different place in your life than them. Just still keeping tabs with them. It's basically two different hangouts. So if you're afraid of like finding new friends and not being able to hang out with the other ones because they, you know, have wives and kids, I don't think anyone's gonna be offended by that. So just do your thing and see if you could find some new people.
I hate how often being a responsible regular at a bar creeps into my life advice, but it sounds like it would kind of, that's like a bullseye for you, I think, if it was responsible. Plus, I've been watching The Wire again, and I just, how often they're at happy hour, like, you know, just hanging out. Good stuff happens to them. It's really bolstered my belief in this, but I really think that as long as you're, you know, you're done with work and, you don't stay out all night, I think those happy hours are a great time to make guy friends around. If they're like, you know, they see you at the same bar a couple times, you know.
So drink more after work.
I said responsibly, though. I did say responsibly. But yes, the essence is drink more. And I hate that. But it's just it nails his problem right there. Drink more, buddy. I mean, I know you're going to take my nuance and just say, oh, crumble it up into a ball and say drink more. But fine. Drink more.
I'm sensing some tension.
Yeah.
The problem is because I know what the job is. It's not realistic. It's not super realistic.
Well, if you're off for the night, right? It's like he's a doctor and all of a sudden he's going to be like, oh, you got to get out of here. Right. I mean, what kind of stuff do you have to do at the drop of a hat when you already are pretty sure you're off? That's what I mean. I'm not saying like, make sure you're there at 5 o'clock on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, because that's when the friends you've made go. I'm just saying when you've got time.
It's kind of a cool job though. And you're around people who I feel like this wouldn't be a problem. Or I don't know. Maybe you think I'm wrong, Ron, because as we talk about a job that nobody else, none of the listeners know what it is, but I feel like it's kind of cool to say what he does. And people are going to want to be friends with you because of that. So it actually won't be that hard for you to make friends.
Yeah, I'll tell you right now, if I'm in a new city and I'm 28 and I have this kid's job, I'm fucking telling everybody. I'm making up shirts.
It's my leading line.
Right. Yeah. So
maybe shy. Like, I get it. Like, you don't want to like throw that in people's faces. But man, I feel like, you know,
it sounds like he's a lot of fun. It sounds like people like him. You know, the nature of the job is that he's not going to be in one place for a long time. The job is very hard. It's very competitive. You kind of have to grind. You got to put in all the hours outside of the job, all those kinds of things.
It sounds like he's a work hard, play hard guy though. Like, it doesn't, I'm not,
but it also sounds like he's too young to be really starting to be worried about this stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you, if I could do anything over, and it's impossible to do it over, I would worry less about the shit. Because you're going to look back on it and go, you know, what wasn't a great use of time was thinking about that for 6 straight months. Or that was a great summer where you just shut it down. You know, like, I just wish I could do it. But, luckily I had to go through those things to understand in the current state of like, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm just going to kind of roll with things right now and not worry about it as much. But I think just 28, 29 is too young to be worrying about some of these things, because most people's stories when they get married and all that kind of stuff, it's way more than half of them where you'll be like, oh, I wasn't even doing this, or I had just broken up, or I just done this thing and I didn't even know. Man, love is just right around the corner for so many of you guys emailing in. You don't even know.
So drink more.
Even know that.
Everybody's so worried. I get it. I was there too. But and to your point, Ryan,
did you care? You didn't care.
I don't know. I got to a certain point where I was definitely looking.
Sorority cared a little bit.
And maybe it was the whole, like, they smelt it on me. But my mayor's now to my wife, like, I wasn't expecting that to happen, and it did. And it was fucking awesome. So, I mean, it's proof that your theory is correct.
What would you be like as single Sorority right now?
Pretty miserable. I mean, like,
I guess that's the right thing to say for a married guy.
No. Like, my life is better in a number of different ways. I never really have the itch to, like, oh man, I just, like, want to get out of the town one morning. Cause I remember guys, like, especially, like, some of my older, like, family members be like, yeah, you're getting married too young. Like, you missed the single life or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know. Not really. Like, if you're in a good relationship and you like the person, like, I don't really miss it that much. Like, sure, maybe like a one-off night I would, but not like long-term. My life is better off now. And I wasn't really pressing for it at the time. So maybe that's the way to play it.
Kyle.
I think I was single for like 6 years, and it just was at the point where I was like, if I'll give it a shot, I would give it a shot if it, you know,
like, so, boy band ass.
Like, what?
I don't know about it, Frolic Room, but
wait, what the hell's going on here?
You don't remember that from old school when he's like, boy band ass?
I don't. Sorry.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Bummer.
Never mind. All right. So you're single for a while.
No, I just was, I think it was like the year before I ended up in a relationship where I was just like, I would give it a shot now. Because I was in LA for a couple years already. So I was like, yeah. I'll do it. I won't do the thing where it's like the first person that comes up to me and that would tolerate me will get into a relationship. So I don't know. It seems like this guy, we're just saying how great it is to be in a relationship for the guy who doesn't have one. So I don't know how we ended up here. but single's good too, man. Enjoy that. That's great. Drink more.
Kyle just looked at me when he said that. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. I was gonna say 2/3 of us are, but yeah, well, Ryan seems to be doing all right. He's fine, you know. He's got a boat now, so things are going well.
We're saying that out loud now, huh? Well, I guess you put it on the Instagram.
I mean, it was on Instagram. What do you want me to do?
So was that the tender to the bigger boat, or was that the whole boat?
No, man, it's a little Zodiac.
Yeah.
Great on fuel.
How many people can fit in that thing?
20 horsepower. 3 comfortably, 4 if we had to.
Oh, okay. So you were just stretching out. In the picture, it looked like you covered a lot of the area of the boat.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably just a mass volume ratio raft thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congrats on the boat, though, now that we can say it out loud.
Pretty excited. Yeah. You know, you're going to watch the swells. You're going to get the weather apps. You're going to make sure you can sailboats, even a Zodiac, they got the right of way. So you're out there trying to, windy Wednesdays. You're coming out of the jetty, windy Wednesdays. That's not about wind horse. That's just about weather. And, you know, anyway. All right. Yeah. I think that covers it.
That was a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah. I don't think that one helped at all. Yeah. I don't know if anything helped today. The Chris Finch interview was good. We'll talk to you on Thursday. Bill and I and other, I'm sure KOC and Kyle, like I'm sure a bunch of people are in the mix. We're doing some draft stuff. We'll kind of, I guess we're going to tape a preview of the draft, and then we'll jump maybe right after the lottery and tape reaction to the lottery. And then I'm going to be ready to go Friday morning, and we're going to have somebody from the Orlando Magic on Friday morning. So we'll tape a Friday pod for you on top of the Thursday. So busy week. Everybody get ready, man. I'm excited. It's my favorite time of the year. And like I said, we'll talk to you Thursday and Friday.